Welcome to the Wide World of Punting, Episode 5, Season 2, in-depth conversations with people from the world of punting. I'm Jacob Wynn from the Tripod. What a great win for the Wide World Bet of the Week last week. The only Formula 1 I watched all year. What a race it was to have some action on. In fact, Monday Aussie time was a great day for people following the bets. From this show, we had Durant in the NBA dropping 51. That checks another leg of the random AF multi. We just needed any Nets player to score 40 plus this year. It's really down to just the Aussies winning the Ashes series against the Poms, and that first test went our way as well. So current odds for that's about $1.10. That was the good news. Straight up, I've got to tell you, with this episode 5, there's been a late change of plan for this week's episode. It was going to be an extra special one that I was really excited about and still is going to come, and hopefully next week. Had some things come up that haven't allowed me to put it together and put in the time and effort that would be required for this special episode. So as I say, that's now going to be a Christmas gift to you guys for next week, and I won't say any more about that one till it's done. So that did leave a little bit of a void for this week, and I really didn't want to let anybody down. I appreciate everyone who tunes in. Still have a great episode for today. I'm going to have my chat with Dan Smith, who's sharing his experience as a racing trader for a bookmaker. Now, if that sounds familiar to you guys, that is because I recorded this chat with Dan during the COVID break in the NRL season in 2020. So that chat was posted on Facebook back at that time. I think we did release it as audio. Depending on how long you've followed, you may have already caught our chat. Now, we never had it on YouTube if you follow there, and it's never been included in any previous episodes of Wide World of Punting. So I also do think there'll be plenty of people watching or listening now who didn't catch this 18 months ago. And if you've got even a casual interest in punting on racing, you'll get a lot out of this interview. Dan's a guy some people may know from the Tripod group. He doesn't post regularly, but anytime he does post, I'm paying attention. He's really knowledgeable with his tips. And what made this chat that I had with him so good was he had left the bookie when he spoke to me. He really held nothing back, told his experiences exactly how they were, what he did in the role of trader, answered every question I threw at him and questions that other people had submitted at the time. This was like a Wide World of Punting in-depth chat ahead of its time. As I said, this was before we even came up with the concept of the series. And while it's been so awesome to have Tristan, you know, nearly every week giving that bookie perspective, this is a different perspective again. This is someone who was at the coalface, moving the odds, accepting, rejecting bets, like analyzing customers to decide how much he respected their money, explaining the odds, how they were actually created, and way more that we cover in this chat. So if you have already watched or listened to this, if you did catch it back at the time in 2020, I do apologize. I strongly feel this episode belongs in the Wide World of Punting catalog. And just with the things that happened this week outside my control, I thought this is the time to bring it in. You know, we've actually had 20 episodes of Wild World of Punting. If you go back, 16 last summer and 4 so far this season. So if you've stuck with us through all that time period, then you know I'm going to be back with plenty more valuable episodes ahead. And I've still also put in the work for another Wide World Bet of the Week. And it's basically an NFL mixed matchup. So I know nobody's going to be mad about that. I'm going to share that at the end of the show. But it's already available on the TopSport website now if you do want to check it out. But okay, enjoy my chat with Dan Smith, the former bookie racing trader. Okay, guys, I'm joined here by Dan Smith, who, as I've told you guys, was a racing trader with a major bookie. We're going to keep it anonymous which bookie that was. But I appreciate the time you're taking today, Dan, to join me and answer a bunch of my questions and questions from the Tripod group. How you going?
Good, mate. No worries. Been looking forward to it.
That's good, mate. I can see you're already on the beers early, although I know New Zealand's a couple hours later, but I can tell people it is Saturday morning. So that's good. You're obviously enjoying life, mate. We'll get right into it. I want to ask, as I said, you were a trader in the racing team at a bookie. So how do you get that job, and what kind of skills does a person need to do a job like that?
Well, mate, it's sort of like, how do you get any job? They put an ad out on Seek, basically. You just apply and hope you get picked for an interview. Personally, I've got a degree in finance, but you don't necessarily need a degree or anything like that to get into the role. I think what really nailed the interview stage for me was we had a good chat about the concept of expected value. And that's really the foundation of any bookmaker, any book is expected value. Like all those prices you see on the screen when you're punting, they're not prices, they're all percentages that are just displayed as prices. And your job as a trader is to essentially limit the risk of that bookie.
That's really interesting stuff. I want to dive into expected value and explain that for people who don't have a full understanding. But just you personally then, were you a punter? Did you have that background? You've obviously got like that kind of analytical mind. Is that what drew you to want to get a job like this?
Yeah, mate, I've always had that sort of mathematical mind. I was primarily a sports punter before that. I punt on mainly rugby league or tennis. I didn't even know what a maiden was, or the difference between a filly or a mare when I started working there. So you absolutely don't even need to understand the product, but it's just those fundamentals underneath. And that shows you, I think, what's important to the bookmaker as well. They were willing to hire me, who didn't really know much about racing, but just understood the underlying theories.
So it's a numbers game. Ultimately, it's all probabilities. Could you run us through then? Because I reckon it's a mystery to people, like day-to-day activities on that job.
I usually started in the afternoons. So when I got in, a lot of the books were already open. But basically, you'd rock in, you'd get a list of races for the day. You might start by checking your markets, making sure everything's open and displaying properly. Nothing worse than having a race close and you don't notice till it's already jumped. Obviously, then you're getting no turnover. There's a lot of information I'd open up on all my screens, different trackers, depending what I was feeling, looking into for the day. So I might want to see all the accounts that deposit $1,000 or more. I'll chuck that on one part of the screen. I might want to see anyone who cashes out for a profit, chuck that on another part of the screen. I might have a list of sort of watched accounts that I'd have on another screen, any bet they make, I want to see it, that sort of thing. And then it's really just going through race to race and watching all that information as it comes in at you.
That's awesome. That's really interesting because I do want to ask a lot about how you dealt with winning punters. I know people are really interested in the behavior of winning punters and how you guys would monitor them and what measures you'd take, because I'm obviously coming from the perspective of trying to get to the truth of the matter, representing, you know, a lot of keen punters out there who either are winning punters or they're aspiring to be. So that is quite fascinating that you'd be getting in there on the job and you keeping an eagle eye on people who, I guess, when you say cash out for a profit, you're talking about people that withdraw from their account, you know, more than they typically deposit, or?
Yeah. There's a good example is Bet365. They've got probably the most prominent cash out feature. Whenever you place a bet, it's right there. On racing, you've probably noticed if you place a bet at $5 and the horse stays around that $5 mark, you can cash out and get your stake back. And what a lot of people probably don't realize is you can, if you see the price dropping, you lock in a high price on Bet365, they bring it in, that cash out value will actually increase. So you can cash out before the race for a profit. And that's the sort of thing that I'd be wanting to see. So someone's beating my prices and they're cashing out before the race, so they're not actually even taking any risk at all.
Yeah, okay, that makes total sense to me. Yeah, they're getting on, and maybe it's educated that they know that that price is a bit too high. They definitely believe it's going to drop. So they put a stake on and, as you're saying, they're not even intending on risking that full stake. Like, they might be intending to cash it out and make that profit. Do you actually think that that's a clever behavior by a punter? I know we always debate in our group, like, never cash out, because if the odds are dropping, you've got a higher chance of winning. But how did you guys deal with people that operate that way?
I mean, it's a good way to make a short-term profit if that's what you're into. And it's risk-free, basically. The only risk you have is that you place a bet and we cut the feature off after you've placed the bet. But basically, you would lose the access to the feature. So you wouldn't be able to cash out anymore.
But I imagine that if someone gets on at like $10, they wouldn't actually get a profit from their cash out until the odds were like lower than 8, or you've got to have that wiggle room, because you're not going to give them like a fair cash out price. So that's what I mean. Then if that horse gets down to $7 before they can even get a little profit, wouldn't they be better? And maybe you're saying they are better long term to just ride those out, but it depends what their mentality is. Is that fair to say?
Right. Yeah, that's fair to say. But even long term, if you're constantly beating the closing price, then you're going to be looked into.
Yeah, of course, of course. I guess that's a key indicator.
That's when you're getting positive expected value, and that's not long-term. Long-term, that's not good for the bookmaker. You're going to be a winning customer if you get your stakes right.
And one way someone could be getting better odds than the closing price could be just they've got really good knowledge and they're looking at the odds and they're thinking, you know, that horse has been priced too high. But is it possible that a punter could have access to almost better tools than you guys, or they're seeing a market shift before you adjust your price, and then they're not even knowledgeable on the horse, but they're slamming in on that price just before you move it because they know they can make an easy profit?
Yeah, we had one customer, so this is out of our entire customer base, who used to do this, and I still don't know how they did it. I wish I did, because I'd be making a lot more money. But yeah, he would chuck a big sum of money on a greyhound primarily. 5 or 10 seconds later, it would just crunch, and he'd locked in that value. And a lot of the
time, would he typically ride those, or would he cash out or mixture?
No, he would keep those.
Yeah, right. And I'm sure that greyhound markets with, you know, smaller relative pools of money involved are more volatile as well. I'm sure it doesn't take as much to crunch in a price.
The most volatile racing markets by far with greyhounds.
And I've got you back there. We lost our connection briefly. It was completely my fault. We were talking about like smaller markets, like with markets with less liquidity, more rural meets, or meets where there aren't going to be as many dollars bet in. And I was wondering how you mitigate your risk there. Maybe you can talk about maybe that you've got lower limits on what you'll take. But you also started talking about how if it's a smaller liquidity market, that's where you might just be more inclined to copy prices. And I really want to get into that because it gets into a topic that a lot of people want to know, which is how you frame your markets in the first place.
Yeah, sure. For starters, though, you're absolutely right about the limits on those markets. Every market has a liability limit, and the more rural meetings, obviously, that's going to be a lot lower because there's less information about a lot of those horses generally. In terms of copying prices, that's quite common. We copy each other's prices all the time. There's two reasons for that. The first is, if someone else is going to frame a market, why would I waste my time doing it? And essentially, you know, if we're both onto it, we probably come up with the same prices anyway. We can generally trust your competitors to have good prices, because 95% of those markets are going to have good prices. There might be the odd one where prices are out. But even if that happens, there might be a lot of punters who don't pick up on that. You know, you're not going to find those bad prices or think that $10 shot should be the favorite unless you're going and doing the form yourself. So you really, there's a lot of information to take in if you're going to find those sorts of those incorrect prices.
Well, I imagine that if you're a smaller operation, you would look to the bigger bookies. There's more risk, I presume, in being the first to put odds out on a field, because if you get it badly wrong, you're going to pay the price, in the sense the punters are going to come for the missed price horses. But I'm really curious in how, were there cases where you guys literally would put out the opening odds and you would handicap a race yourselves? You talked about expected value and that every price reflects, I guess, an inverse percentage, taking into account your profit as well of what you think it works. So I'm really interested in how you frame a market, what factors go in, and then also the mechanics around, I guess, comparing with your competitors.
Yeah, sure. So I never framed any markets that went live, but a few of the other guys did. But I would frame some markets just for practice out of interest. And the best way to learn how the bookie does it is to do it yourself. So that is, take a meeting next week in Australia somewhere that's not got any prices, and just pick a race and price it yourself, and see what you come up with. You know, the first time you do it, you're probably going to get it completely wrong, but you'll learn from that. And when the bookies put up their prices, you'll be able to compare and maybe start tweaking your processes. I do actually have a bit of a list here about that.
Yeah, because a lot of people wouldn't know where to begin. I mean, I guess I would imagine you'd look at a field and first thing you would try and assess all the runners and figure out which is the best chance to win, and then figuring out what percentage it is and then working down from that. But I'm pretty ignorant on how that gets built.
So the key piece of information would be sectionals, race times and sectionals. You can usually get finishing times pretty much anywhere on the internet, but true sectionals broken down by every few hundred meters are really hard to get, and you've usually got to pay for them. They're not very common at all. That's obviously the key piece of information. When I was doing it, I picked Singapore to start learning to frame my markets on, because there's a finite pool of horses there and it's only one track. Because if you try to start doing it in Australia for a newbie, there's thousands of horses and there's hundreds of tracks, so it's a lot more difficult. Average prize money is a really good one to look at. Better horses are going to have a higher average prize money. Then you've got their overall record, their recent record. You know, you're not going to frame, it might be a horse that's won 50 out of 100 races at 10 years old, but it hasn't won for 2 years. It's not going to have a good price anymore. And then to a lesser extent, you've got things like the going, the jockey, the trainer, the trainer's record. Some jockeys will have a bigger influence on price. Like if you're framing a market at Ascot and you've got a $2 favourite and you see who's riding it, fuck, it's Willie Pike, you're going to bring it into like $1.80, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many factors.
The sectionals, the speed, and where you think the horse is going to settle are probably the three main.
That's interesting. Well, because I've had like a guy called Jason Campbell in an interview, and he talked about all the different factors. And it does seem to me like there's so many and variabilities that ultimately does it boil into a mathematical model almost? Because there'd be so much discretion that you'd use. Like, let's go back to sectionals, which you've said is like you've pointed to one of the key factors, right? So obviously a horse that's got quicker sectional times is generally going to be better, but it could have been in a race that was run at a slower tempo. It could have been poor
That's
weather
right,
conditions
yeah.
on the day. Like, so even within one variable, that can vary so many times. So I know that it's probably a mix of art and science, but is it ultimately boiled down in like into a mathematical model?
When I was doing it, it would be in Excel. I think a lot of what we do at the book is in Excel tables, those sorts of things. But you can generally pick what you think are going to be the three or four favorites in the market, and you can kind of frame it around them and then build it out with those rougher horses. It's usually pretty obvious when you've got a class horse in a field that's going to be the one that people are going to go for.
So you would have all the different factors in your Excel spreadsheet and then kind of work out weightings of like how important each of those factors are, maybe tweak them to ultimately produce like a predictive value relative to all the other runners. And then as you talked about mapping it, like where they're going to settle and all the other factors, like I guess the barrier draw and stuff like that.
I would start with the finishing times and then I'd adjust it for the weight of the horse. And obviously the longer or shorter the distance it's running, the bigger that weight becomes a factor. Mm-hmm. And then I'd start going down to the sectionals and being like, do I think this is going to be a quickly run race, a slowly run race? And go from there. So there is, while there's a lot of mass involved, there's also still that human sort of manual element.
And you're saying that's how you did it to kind of learn. Is it just basically people who were senior to you did it for real and did it like for the odds that would actually represent your company that you'd post?
That's right.
And what percentage of races would you guys actually put up odds before competitors or odds that, you know, fully vulnerable to be smashed by punters?
We would put up a lot of the Kiwi races first.
Uh-huh. Yep. And what did you find? Like,
stuff.
Did you find that there were like kind of vultures or maybe that's not the right word, but I guess people out there that were ready to swoop in the second that a market was opened up to try and grab what they would consider a mistake price?
Not as much as you would think. Like 95% of the money would come in that 5 to 10 minutes before the race starts. Even if someone jumps in early, if it's just a normal account and their profile is just a general punter, that's not going to raise any suspicions from me. If I see a restricted account who's bidding early on those prices, then that'd probably make me bring it in a little bit. But the reason they're restricted is so they can't get as much on as they probably like.
And is that also because you had lower limits a little bit further out from the race? Like, would you increase limits of how much people could put down on a race closer to the jump?
Yeah. So, yeah, as you get closer to the jump, the prices have shifted around, and you can be more certain that they're as close to correct as possible. So you absolutely would increase the limits that people could get on the closer you got to the race start time.
And it's the same, I should say this from my experience sports betting, that like it's not the be all end all, but I would suggest to people that that closing price is as close to the truth as what the odds should be as any during the time that a market is open. And that's why you said that you guys recognized if punters were consistently getting a better price than what it closed at, that is a key indicator that they know what they're doing. And it's the same for sports, I could say.
Yeah, 100%.
And people have asked about trends that you've noticed of when big money was smashed down. Like, so I guess you've kind of answered that the big bets often would come close to the jump. But doesn't that mean that those big punters aren't always getting the best odds because they're betting into a more, I guess, sculpted or refined market within that race?
Yeah, that's correct. In most cases, just because they're betting big, it doesn't mean they're betting smart. You might just have a mug punter who happens to be a rich guy in real life who just enjoys a punt and he's a big losing customer. So big money is not always smart money.
On that note, if you're going to take a big bet, let's just say if someone drops a few thousand on a favorite, do you look at like, or who was that? And if it was, as you say, just a rich guy who likes to back a favorite, would that be a case where you'd be like, we're not going to move the odds, we feel comfortable what we've got it? Whereas if it's a customer that you've identified has an edge and they're smashing that money on, would it actually move the odds?
If it was a smart customer early, it would move the odds. Late, not really any amount of money is going to move the odds. I'm more following what the market does than where the money's going on my books.
That's really interesting. So can you talk about that, the mechanics of like you've opened your market, right? And whether you guys have framed it yourself or you're saying you've copied one of your big competitors and you've, you know, tweaked it a little bit and here's your opening odds. And this, I don't know, if it's a Wednesday race meet, you might have put this out, the day before, a couple of days before your openers?
Yeah.
Yep. And then those odds, as everybody knows, move over time right up till the jump. And I think, a typical punter has some concept that it's to do with the weight of money, but you're not going to necessarily leave a horse at really long odds if you're seeing your competitors wind it in. You're not going to wait for a big bet to kind of smash those odds in. You're probably going to move with the market. So can you talk about the mechanics of moving your odds?
Yeah, that's right. Like if I see them moving it in, there's a reason they're moving it. So that's information for me and I'm going to follow them. Money, late money is not such a big deal. I've already got my prices. I'm confident they're right. I'm confident that you're getting bad value. So get as much on as you want, as far as I'm concerned. The biggest mover in price when you get closer to that race time is Betfair. I would always have Betfair open on my screen when I was trading, 100%. That's the most useful tool by far for racing. And that basically is because my price has to be below whatever the lay price for that runner is on Betfair. Otherwise, there's an arbitrage opportunity.
That's also, I was going to ask you about Betfair. So maybe I understand exactly what you're saying, but maybe you could explain a tiny bit further what you're talking about, like what, you know, arbitrage and why you need to avoid that.
Yeah, ARBS is basically betting on the sum of all outcomes. So you can't lose. You're locking in a profit basically before the race even starts. So if you back a horse at 10s and you get a grand on it, to win 10,000, you might lay it at 850 for a similar amount, and then you might be able to lock in that sort of $500 or $600 profit either way. So whether the horse wins or loses, you've locked in your profit before that race starts there.
Yeah, and I can clearly see if somebody can just take advantage of your prices and they can set up an opportunity where they can't lose, then you're probably giving them overs on that price. You know how you said you looked at competitors? I mean, are you looking at information that is not available to your typical punter, or are you just looking at the posted prices of other bookies? And I know you say you look at it, but is it automated? Because I can't imagine that you're literally physically scanning every race. Let's say, bloody, there's some, you know, race at Alice Springs in Australia on a Tuesday arvo, and somebody in Australia has had a big bet, you know, on race three or whatever, but you might not come across that. But is it automated that your odds will adjust somehow?
Yeah, so the intraday pricing is all automated. And we can see the percentage, what we want our market percent to be, and where we want to take the prices from. Like, you might just take them all from one competitor, or you might blend five or six together to get your prices. If someone places a big enough bet, it's going to trigger a sort of a warning if it's close enough to that liability limit, and that's going to pop up, and then I'll go and look at it. But that probably wouldn't make me move my prices. If I go and look at the market, say, oh, my price is fine, this guy just wants to have a big punt on this horse, sweet as, get on.
You know how you said it'll flag? Does that mean that there's knowledge sharing across the bookies? Otherwise, how would you have any idea that someone put like 10 grand on a horse on Sportsbet?
No, so not across bookies, just with us. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So
if someone punts big on a competitor, we wouldn't know that.
And the only way you would know is if you saw that they thought that money was like was actually wise, and then they moved their odds accordingly. You can just see your competitor's odds, just the same as any average punter who's got all the apps can check other bookies. Can you name any of the bookies, I don't know if you can or not, in particular that you thought were usually pretty on the ball, that you would look to as a good guide, and maybe they moved their odds a bit quicker than others?
Yeah, I use a tool called Dynamic Odds, which is available online. You do have to pay for it, but there's a good write-up about it on Betfair. It's one of the tools that they recommend. It's basically just an odds comparison tool. So you can see all the bookies for every race that you want to look at, and it's got all the prices just in rows. I found Top Sport, TAB, and Sportsbet generally pretty onto it with their pricing. All the other bookies seem to sort of follow a lot of what they do. And Bet365 is by far and away the worst with their pricing. So they're a good one to try and take advantage of.
Oh, that's interesting. That's good for punters to know where they can look, because we always encourage people to shop around. So my point is, like, if a punter has five different betting apps on their phone, don't just bet on the horse that you think is going to win at $5 before you've at least checked all the other bookies and you know you're getting the best price.
Especially a lot of the time, if you want to back roughies as well, you might see, I found BetEasy's got some of the worst racing prices out of any of the Australian corporates. They might have a rough at 21 to win and 3 to place, and they've got the same on Bet365 for 61 to win and 7 to place. So why would you want to bet with BetEasy if you want to back that horse?
Some of the discrepancies
are pretty big.
Yeah, and that is really just good general advice about shopping around, because some people will just be like, I'm going to bet for the day. I'm depositing my money into one account, like, just because it's easier and they're more comfortable with that particular app. But they could be missing out on, you know, massive, as you say, discrepancies in prices. Mm. Just a different one, but a lot of people who've ever put a big bet on know that what happens when it says processing or under review before that bet gets accepted. So maybe with your experience on the other side of the counter, can you talk us through, like, actually what you're doing in those moments that a bet is being reviewed before it's either accepted or rejected, or, you know, partially accepted?
Yeah, so if that's my race that I'm trading, it will come up on my screen as a warning, and your account will pop up, and I'll basically just have a quick look. I'll check the prices, right? If it looks fine and there's nothing suspicious about your account, then that's fine, I'll let you on. But if you're maybe a sharper punter, or I've already got a high liability on that runner, I might decline your bet.
And this is another thing I wanted to ask you, right? Because you describe your job as a trader. And to me, I don't know, like, back in the day, the olden days of bookies, I guess that you'd have a bunch of bookies, let's say on course at a track, and they're all taking, you know, bets, and each of them are going to get different bets on different runners. And then what they might do is kind of trade bets a little bit to kind of balance their books and balance their liability. But these days, you've got all your different kind of online bookies and you're all taking your bets, and for sure you're going to be lopsided, and you're hoping that as long as you're taking bets at a price that's palatable to you, you'll come out on top. Is there actually any form of trading? Do you have kind of avenues to actually reduce liability by sharing that risk elsewhere?
I think there was only one occasion where we ended up having a massive liability on one horse, and we went and put a 20 grand bet on with a competitor.
But other than that, you actually didn't trade as such then. Is that fair to say that that's just a job title now?
More of a job title now than, I guess, what it used to be when there were those on-course bookies.
Cool. Well, I think that's really interesting for people to understand. So when you say you can only recall one time where you had a huge liability, is that just because of the market percentages that typically you guys were in a pretty balanced position most races, that you're managing your what bets you're accepting, so you're never really going to be in a terrible spot on any given bet on any given race?
Yeah, so I'm not sure what happened with that one, but from memory it was quite substantial. It was like $500,000 or something like that. You might get some of those big metro races where you're losing, you know, Randwick or Caulfield, whatever, where you might be losing 100 grand on one horse, but then you're making money on all the other runners. So the books aren't always balanced in that sense, but you're confident that even if the punters get one up on you in one race, they're going to keep betting throughout the day. And because every single book is framed in my favour, they're going to give a lot of that money back.
Yeah, I think that's awesome that you explained that, because people might think that you've got all your prices below kind of what you think the win percentages should reflect, so you can't lose on any race. But the truth is, there can still be a weight of money on a given runner. I'm interested with like your public recreational bettors. Do they, it's probably a mix, but do people gravitate to picking favourites, or do like your recreational punters, do you find they like to back a roughie because they can win a lot for risking a little?
Yeah, there's different types of punters. The most common is obviously just your general favourite backer. It might be just down the pub or having a few beers. There are a few people that would back roughies. Like there's never a race where there's not at least some money on every single runner. But the vast majority of money is usually on the favourite. And if it's not, you've probably got your prices wrong.
Uh-huh. And I'm also very interested in the mechanics of the parimutuel totes, because I'm assuming your bookie, you'd obviously offer people to bet on runners at a fixed price. You're obviously offering fixed price odds on every race, but you'd also let people get on at the tote if they'd prefer. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Yep. And then if someone puts a big bet on and they choose to bet on the tote, so I don't know if, you know, whether it be a specific tote or mid tote or top tote, are you guys just taking that risk yourself and you're just going to pay the punter out at whatever that tote price reflects, or are you actually somehow sending that money into the pool that the tote is kind of designed to calculate?
Yeah, so it depends on the bookmaker. So for example, if you bet through TAB, you're betting directly into the pools, so your bet is going to affect the price. So if you want to get a big bet on the tote, especially on a smaller race, it's probably not a good idea, because you're really going to bring the price of bet selection down. And you've probably seen some really hot favourites. When the tote price comes up on screen, it's paying like a dollar. So you just get your money back. Whereas if it lost, you would have got nothing at all. And basically, the bookie takes a percentage of the pool. It might be about 17-18% of that pool. So literally can't lose on the tote. And the rest of it gets paid out to the winning punters based on the weight of money on the winning runner.
Look, this has been awesome. I've got a little bit more to get through, but my last few topics, it's all around winning punters. This is what people are really interested in, whether they are a winning punter or they want to know the behaviors and habits of winning punters, and they want to know how the big bad bookies, who you're representing in this interview, how they dealt with it. And you've touched on it a lot. Here's a question: like, what are you looking for? You already mentioned beating starting price and stuff, but in order to flag people, limit people, and remove their promos.
Yeah, sure. So it's no secret that bookies restrict punters. Start with promos, and that's a good one. Most of the promos that the bookies throw up are going to be negative expected value for the bookmaker. So if you only ever bet promos, over time you should be up. Now, if you're only betting promos, then they're going to take those off you. I think the excuse is that it's an abuse of the product is the excuse that the bookies give out. But it's basically because they want you to win those promos. And then the idea is you'll go and lose your money later in the day. You might deposit again, start chasing your losses, that sort of thing. That's why they offer those to punters. If you're only betting promos, you're gonna make money because they're designed to give away free money. So the bookie's going to take those away from you in the hopes that you'll keep punting without them and become a losing customer.
And so you've definitely talked about having an awareness of some punters kind of being winning punters. But are you still obliged with minimum bet laws to keep them on, or were you guys closing accounts? But I also know you talked about people physically placing bets at venues. You surely can't really stop somebody because you don't know their identity when they're betting, at a venue as opposed to online or on an app. So how did you guys deal with winning punters?
Yeah, we didn't actually close many accounts fully. We would restrict them to stake factors of 0.2 was one of the worst you could get, which is 20% of the normal max bet for a general punter. The quickest way to get noticed by far is just to place big bets, because if you're placing like $1,000, $10,000 bets, you're going to get noticed straight away, and someone's going to go and look into you and your activity and what you're doing. You talk about the betting shops. Yeah, that's a good one. Basically, if you're betting through paper tickets, like the good old days, they don't know who you are. We don't know who you are. So if you're a winning punter and you're kept off from everywhere, you'll still be able to get on at those betting shops with paper tickets.
Yeah, so there's no real way you can stop them, but you still, I guess, have that ability in your office or in your team to review bets and decide. Like, they'd still have that issue if they're trying to bet at a price that you guys don't want to accept.
Yeah, that's right. But the stakes got to be above the liability limit for that to come through to me to accept or decline. If they're a sharp punter, they've probably figured out what my liability limits are by now. So they know how much to bet to stay under those limits and make sure their bets get on.
Yeah, I can speak even my own experience in sports betting and stuff. You kind of know you don't want to like tip off the bookie and bet too big, even when you see odds that you know are great. So you try and find ways to just like sail under the radar. And you're like, what you're talking about, it does present an opportunity for people out there who are smaller punters who just want to put a couple bucks, $5, $10 here and there. They could probably cruise along. And even if they have a method that gives them an advantage, you guys, they're not an issue to you guys, Matt, really, in the scheme of things. And they're definitely not going to,
right,
flag straight away. So,
some guys who are a bit harsher, like I know sports bet can be pretty rough, even with small time punters. They just get rid of everyone for some reason. but there's a lot of bookies out there that you can, especially on those smaller stakes, if you're just like a $10 or $20 punter, you can cruise along quite nicely for generally a long time before you start getting people looking at you.
Yeah, I guess it's the dilemma then. Like, if you've got an edge, the only real way to maximize your profit, you either got to keep improving your edge or increasing your stake size. And that's where you're saying that eventually the bookie's going to find out about you. But as you said, people who have the ability to get on with paper tickets can get around that to an extent, as long as they're staying under the liability limits.
We will keep a record of every bet your account ever makes, so you can go and review that at any time. Obviously, the best and fastest way to get noticed is big bets. But even those smaller bits over time, someone might come along and notice that, hey, this guy's actually up, you know, $10,000 just doing $20 bits. So eventually you're probably still going to get caught out. But yeah, as you say, those paper tickets, there's a record of them, but we don't know who placed them. And even if we did, you can't really stop someone from just going into the shop anyway. So
no,
for those sharp punters who are restricted from everywhere, you still do have a way to get on at those betting shops.
Yeah, and that's interesting. What about, so when you look at, you said that, you know, the big bets draw the most attention. So if someone's had a big day and won a lot of money on a given day, are you looking into their bets and just seeing they could have been that punter you spoke about at the start of this interview who's pretty wealthy and just backs whatever, and he might have just got lucky? So is that where you're analysing their bets to see, do they just get lucky for that day or that span, but we're happy to kind of keep their business?
It depends if we know them or not. Like, if they're a relatively new account, we'd want to probably dig into it a bit more and find out what they're up to. But if your account's a bit older, we know your betting patterns. We can see how much you're down or up over the lifetime of your account. If you have a good day, you know, good for you. You beat us, take it. And, you know, we'll probably see you tomorrow and you'll give a lot of it back.
And was there anything that stuck out to you in terms of the behaviour of these guys who you did identify as winning punters, like the way they bet? Did they bet at certain times, either opening markets or close to jump? Were they betting fixed or tote? You know, even were they ever betting the place versus win? Was there any kind of strategies that revealed themselves of how these guys were beating you?
It's a good question. I guess all of them were actually quite different in a way. There wasn't many winning punters. Could probably count them on both hands, to be honest. That's how small the pool is of people who actually make money. There was one guy who liked to bet on Singapore races, and he would sort of pick sometimes two or three or four horses in a race. And he would bet it early to try and lock in value. And he was doing quite well over time. Like, he was up a significant amount of money from that strategy. You might see other punters who do like to bet those exotics, the trifectas and the first fours, hard to hit, but when you get a payout, it's usually pretty decent. And if you're betting through the actual pools as opposed to a corporate, you're not taking their money anyway, so they don't care how much you win on the tote pools, so you can go for your life there. The biggest winning punter I ever saw, who is a guy who used to bet through those betting shops, so I still don't know who he is or how he did it. He would bet greyhounds, Australian greyhounds only, and he would bet right at the jump, and without fail every time. About 10 seconds after his bet come in, the price would just crunch crazy, and the majority of those winners got up, and he would be making six figures a year just punting.
Wow, there you go. But that, I obviously, that's few and far between. Like, did you work in there, did you have a sense of, like, of all your clients, what percentage of them do you think were actually up long term?
It's got to be less than 1%.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really small, you know. Most guys probably don't keep a track of their betting, you know, so you don't actually know how much you're up or down in your lifetime, whereas I have that information in front of me because every bet you place is recorded straight away.
Mm-hmm. Well, that goes to show that it's not something that's easy to do. You know, you talked about all the different factors that you guys are trying to assess and build in to what you think should be the fair prices of, you know, in a typical racing field. To me, there's obviously a lot of unknowns, but I imagine that, like, as well as the people who watch replays and might look at a horse that just didn't get a fair opportunity and therefore had bad sectionals and whatever reason because it got stuck in traffic, I feel like inside information must play a huge part across gallops, trots and greyhounds. Like, the trainer knows, he's seen this thing, this animal run around, you know, in their paddock, and knows this thing has not shown how good it is, you know, in actual races yet. And that inside information is going to be passed on to people who will then bet that animal at a higher price. So that's where I feel like being able to see the way the market is moving is a critical thing. And that guy who you said won money on greyhounds, maybe he was a greyhound genius, maybe he just saw the late money come for those dogs and got on just before you guys adjusted, right?
Yeah, that could be correct. I still don't know how he did it, but it could be he had a source that, yeah, that could tell him the price is coming in, the price is about to come in, get on now. You know, that was our sort of theory, that he had some outside source, probably someone in Australia in the industry. But as I say, we don't know who he is, so we couldn't really do anything about it.
Yeah, so you've got markers that you can identify, you know, who are successful punters. It doesn't necessarily always mean that you know what their method was to success, but just that in a long term, they were getting good prices and it was allowing them to win. But as you said, your estimation was less than 1% of your clients were doing that. Yeah. Although in fairness, they might have been bigger, better. So it might represent more than 1% of the turnover might be coming from smart punters. But people do need to understand that part of your job you've described was investigating these people and trying to work against them and not letting them get down too big.
That's right.
I'll kind of wrap it up there. I really appreciate this interview. I found it really interesting. I'm sure a lot of people will. But in the kind of 18 months that you worked there, was there any other like really interesting things that happened or any like key changes that you noticed that they did over that time? And can you finish by explaining why you left and what you do now?
There wasn't too many key changes. We sort of just kept going as we were the whole time I was there. I did notice that a lot of the sort of newer punters these days tend to be a bit more onto it. They use a lot more data analysis, which I think is something these bookies sort of need to get real on. They're not just going to have the old guy who's half pissed down the pub throwing money around the ponies anymore. You've got guys who are actually doing data analysis, and you can't just ban them all, or you're not going to have any customers left. So I think there's definitely some bookies who are making headway in that space, and there's some who are going to fall behind, and eventually they'll just sort of disappear. I had a chat with Paul Bittar, who's an exec from Sportsbet, just by chance one time, and he said to me he doesn't even see Sportsbet as a bookie. He sees it as a data analysis company, and the majority of their staff aren't racing traders, they're data analysts, and they're just trying to work out how to get you to get more turnover, more money on, deposit money into your account and just keep punting, because they're confident that in the long term you're going to give them more of your cash.
That is really interesting.
Yeah, in terms of what I do now, I actually work at the stock market, so transition from racing to shares, I guess, shares and equities, that sort of thing. It's actually a lot more similar than you might think, especially the exchange side of it. So Betfair is a betting exchange, the ASX is a stock exchange. At the fundamental level, they're really the same thing. It's just a different product. One's selling equities and debt, and the other's selling bets on racing.
That's interesting. Yeah, clearly you've transitioned to a field that you know, has a lot of similarities and suits your background with the finance degree and your analytical mindset. Was there a reason you left the betting industry then? Was it just a more lucrative opportunity came up, or was there any other reasons why you didn't want to keep working up as a trader?
No, it wasn't really a reason. It was just a place I'd always wanted to work for. So when the opportunity came up, I went and took it. There wasn't really any reason that I left being a trader. It was actually a really fun and insightful job. You pretty much turn up, you know, you've got tallies everywhere. It's like a giant man cave. You've got every sport you can think of on TV, yep. And you're getting paid to sit there and watch it and watch bets all day.
Do you still punt yourself, you know, recreationally, or even try and punt with an edge in any fields?
Yeah, the way I punt now, I punt for value. So I'm always trying to beat the closing price. Unfortunately, we don't have too many accounts left anymore, which is the case. I'm sure you guys are aware. But there's always, I guess, those ways around it, exploring going to the betting shops once you lose your last account, or starting a new strategy just through Betfair.
Yeah, you talked about how you can see that punters are getting more sophisticated. I've seen the same thing across sports betting markets where years ago, it used to be easier. I feel like the lines that you used to be able to get on a footy game, an underdog that back in the day used to be plus 12 and a half, these days is plus 8.5 because people aren't overreacting. Like the marketplace is more sophisticated, is sharper. It ultimately does mean it's harder than ever to win money punting because of that knowledge within the marketplace. So I reckon anyone who's trying to do that also needs to be constantly getting better and evolving. And yeah, on top of that, the knowledge in the marketplace that you're trying to bet into, you've got smart bastards like you working on the other side who are working against us, you know, working against the punter, trying to limit the amount they can win. So it definitely isn't easy. And you've given us an awesome insight into the other side of the counter, which a lot of people probably didn't have a clear picture. So I really appreciate it, mate. Thanks for the time. This will be available as an audio and video podcast for people to consume. And, you know, if people have a good response to this, maybe we can have a chat down the track, because I'm sure there's even plenty more topics we can go into. But I really appreciate your time, Daniel.
Yeah, no worries, mate. Cheers, Jacob.
Thanks again to Dan for being so open, sharing that great insight to anyone who's ever wondered what it would be like to do that job or what they actually do, what the traders do in that job. Let's be honest, like if you're trying to win money, it's the people that are in a position like Dan was in who you're essentially up against. And you know what they say in the art of war, know your enemy. Now we move to Wide World Bet of the Week. As I said at the top, $2.25 winner last week. We had the UFC fight. We wanted it to go as many rounds as possible. Well, it was action packed. It went into the third round, which was close to expectation, probably put us our noses slightly ahead, especially when it came to the Formula One. Verstappen qualified in pole position. We just needed him to finish top two to win our bet, and he was like $2 alone to win the race. So we're sitting in a good position. But from the moment that race began, basically all hell broke loose. This is not the pod for me to try and explain to you what happened in that race, other than to say, if you didn't already catch the result, he ended up first. So we cashed that bet. I'm not going to tempt the punting gods to go as far as to say the random AF multi is home, but boy, we're taking some big steps where we must be 90% or better shot to win that one as well. As I explained last week, with that boxing bout being cancelled, that leg's a push. The recalculated odds on the random AF will be $5, but it's looking as close as you can get to a winner. We'll see how that goes with the cricket leg still to come. So this week I looked what's on, and what's most exciting to me is it's the first time in the NFL season this year where we've got games being played on the Aussie weekend. Up until now, big slate every Monday. There's a game Tuesday and a game Friday, Aussie time. Well, now we've got a doubleheader Sunday, Aussie time. That's just perfect for a mixed matchup. For people who don't often have free time to catch the games, maybe now you can, and you can have a fun bet on it. I know what you're thinking. You hear mixed matchup, you're seeing dollar signs. I've got to always say, these are never sure things, but I do love this one. It is the Browns and Patriots combined team totals to outscore the Raiders and Colts combined. So the first game Sunday our time, we've got the Browns hosting the Raiders. We're just cheering the Browns, simple as that. The Raiders have had a really messed up year, and I mean, last week they lost by 40. You always think maybe a team could bounce back. Hey, it's possible. They're a very unpredictable team. I haven't forgotten that they spoiled our Thanksgiving, but I know we're going to get a good performance out of the Browns. They nearly choked on a big lead last week, got a huge scare, but they clung on, and that is huge for them because they're still massively in the playoff hunt, 40% roughly to make the playoffs, including a real genuine shot to still win their division. When you're in that situation, now you're a home favorite, it's just must win. Whereas the Raiders, you can say they're still in the playoff hunt, but they're sub 5% to make the playoffs. I look at a team like that late in the year with all the adversity they've had. There's a possibility of a collapse with that kind of being out of reach. So another thing to factor in for this game, it could have bad weather, it's an outdoor stadium. Now that's going to affect the scoring of both teams equally, so it's not going to hurt our bet. But if anything, the Browns are a team that actually is suited to playing football in poor weather conditions because they're more effective the less they pass the ball, to be honest. We move to the next game, and what we'll basically be cheering is for the Patriots to do better than the Raiders had done in the previous game. So however close the Raiders got to the Browns, we need the Patriots to go 1 point better, whether it's a loss and they can't lose by that many, or if the Raiders pull the upset, we need the Patriots pull the upset by 1 point more. And I do think this will be a great game, Patriots versus Colts. Patriots are actually a slight underdog as well. They're plus 2.5 in this game, and the Raiders in the previous game were plus 3. So that's where you're looking at, like, it is roughly 50-50 this play in terms of the market, but I really like it for a number of reasons. I talked about why I think the Browns will have success against the Raiders. And then you look at the Colts. Well, they're favorite in this game because they're a good team too. They held their opponent to zero last week, but their opponent was dismal. The Pats didn't score many points last game, but they were playing in some of the worst weather conditions of the season. And what I love about the Patriots in the spot this week is they are now off a bye. You have Mac Jones going to win Offensive Rookie of the Year. This is the game you come in and just leave no doubt about that. Belichick probably going to win Coach of the Year. You combine that off a bye, off a gigantic confidence-boosting win. And never mind whether, if you're questioning whether the Patriots need to win this game, look, playoffs is locked up. Division, massive box seat. But they are 66% to finish the number one seed. And that is all important in terms of your pathway to make the Super Bowl. So there's no doubt in my mind they'll put up a great performance for us. They'll give us value for money. And we get $2.25. We do lose in a tie scenario with the two combined teams if they finish on exactly level pegging. That's what's built into giving us those nice juicy odds. But I'm telling you, I love it. Two games worth of excitement. Find it under NFL on Top Sport if you like it too. If you still haven't joined, use that promo code Tripod. If you're joining them, they make this show possible as well, and they make these awesome bets possible for us. And nobody gets cut off from these bets like some of the markets that Dan was talking about in our chat. Good luck if you're on board with me. Good luck on any punting endeavors you have this week. I'll see you next week for the special episode. Lego!